You're listening to Booth Talk from the Aftermovie Diner, and on this episode we're incredibly happy to have Scott Spiegel. He's the writer of Evil Dead 2, he's the writer of The Rookie, directed and starring Clint Eastwood. He has also got a fantastic new DVD collection out of some early Super 8 shorts that he made with the likes of Bruce Campbell, Josh Becker, Sam Raimi and more. We have an absolutely fantastic conversation for the next hour, all about that stuff, about how he introduced Lawrence Bender to Quentin Tarantino, all about working with Bruce Campbell and Tom Sullivan and on The Evil Dead 2 and The Rookie and Tales of Hollywood, and we even get into how Pam Grier touched my beard. It's all here right now on this fantastic interview. I don't want to wait any longer. Here is the one, the only, the legendary Mr. Scott Spiegel. Mr. Spiegel?
Yeah, this is he.
Hey, how are you doing, Scott? This is John Cross again from the Aftermovie Diner.
Oh, indeed. Yes, indeed. It's 7:30. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, sir. And yourself?
Oh, excellent.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Aftermovie Diner, and we're all thrilled, all us Evil Dead fans and Michigan Mafia fans, with your current project, the Super 8 Shorts. So as they are at the start of your career, let's begin there. What, to the uninitiated, are the Super 8 Shorts?
I guess just shorts I did with Bill Ward and Matt Taylor, and very shortly thereafter, Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi. And we were just knucklehead kids doing Three Stooges comedy ripoffs, you know, just because slapstick is great when you've got Super 8 silent film. What are you going to do, right?
Right.
You're not going to do a Hamlet. And we're not going to, you know, it's not going to do that.
Yeah.
And we started out using kind of a chalkboard, you know, like an old silent movie, and then we just dispensed with that. And just would tape the Three Stooges off afternoon TV, and we used to learn to, you know what, it was like we were pioneers in a weird way, only in the sense pioneers may not be the best term, but we were kind of, it must have been like 100 years earlier when everybody was just figuring it out. Okay, they had the film existed, now how do we make a movie and, you know, put that on screen, you know?
Right.
And, you know, all the early movies look very stodgy. Actually, you know what? I lied. All the silent movies had so much energy that they became stage-bound and stodgy once sound came in.
Right.
You know? That's what's so hilarious, because you see some of those incredible earlier silent Laurel and Hardys and all the Glenn Keaton and Chap, all the greats, and that stuff is, you know, it's amazing visually. Be that as it may, that's what we were kind of doing, and we even had sound to go with our silent movies on a reel-to-reel tape recorder that looked almost identical to the Evil Dead tape recorder.
Right.
And that's how we taped them, you know, the Stooges off TV. And then, of course, very shortly thereafter, 73, 74, somewhere about around late 73, cassette tapes all of a sudden suddenly appeared. Really, it's weird. It's like I'm talking about the Stone Age, man, in a way I am. But it's just like going, that was a big deal, because like, oh, great, I can get a tape recorder for $9, and cassette tapes were, you know, $1 for three or 60-minute cassette audio tapes. And there you have it. But so clumsily, kind of, we just kind of, you know, did our thing, and really like 1976. And by that time, Sam and Bruce, we were all collaborating, co-directing, co-writing, co-starring. That we met up with a famous person, Tommy Smothers, you know, who discovered everybody from Rob Reiner to Steve Martin. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, he was part of the Smothers Brothers. Bruce Campbell was assisting him in some sense on a summer stock up in Traverse City at the Cherry County Playhouse in the summer of 76. And Bruce Campbell said, hey, you want to see our movies? Of course, by that time, we lived right near where Jimmy Hoffa was kidnapped, and we did the Hoffa, you know, the James Hoffa story. That
sure.
Was the Sam, Bruce, and me. and Bruce played Jimmy Hoffa. And and of course, Tommy Smothers, you know, he obviously has a strong political bent. He just got a huge kick out of it and was fascinated. Bruce had a projector called a Humic projector, had variable speed on it. And so I could, like, here I am with the audio cassette tape, and they never really sunk up. I love that word, sunk. they just were never in sync.
Right.
And so it was like, so it was cool to have a projector that kind of slowed it down. The only drawback was the picture got a little dimmer. But, man, you know, when you want that sound effect to sync up and everything, it was amazing. And that was right around 76, 77 that we did gravitate to sound,
yeah,
Super 8 film. And we're also experimenting with 16-millimeter shorts.
You guys were also pioneers in a way. It's very, very commonplace now, I mean, especially with the internet, with phones being able to shoot film and everything else. But you guys were sort of the first generation of filmmakers who had that formative experience of kind of like making movies in the back garden, because stuff like Super 8 film and Super 8 cameras were available. You know, the generation before you didn't necessarily have that available to have at home. It's like, you know, my generation had the home computer for the first time. And it's,
right,
it's, you know, and then obviously by the time you get to the 80s, camcorders and VHS recorders,
right,
and various other things are available. So then you get another wave of people like the Edgar Wrights of the world who have been making films.
Right.
They make films in their back garden, and they make movies, and they kind of follow yours and Bruce's and Sam's kind of mold of, well, we make movies with our friends first, and then let's see if we can do one that's a bit more professional. But I think that in that way, you guys were pioneers, yeah?
Well, that's cool. I appreciate it. Yeah, I can't disagree with you. And it was just kind of interesting, too, to note that, you know, it was expensive.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, you know, $1.50 to develop, you know, in the early 70s. And then, you know, $2-3 for a 3-minute roll of film cartridge. And you really had to know your stuff. I mean, the kind of cool thing is now, you know, you can do a feature on your iPhones, and, you know, that kind of a deal.
Sure.
You know, Paranormal Activity and whatnot.
Yeah, they won't be very good, but you can do it.
that's true in a lot of ways. However, it's kind of cool to know that, hey, this is free. I can do 1,000 takes if I want.
Sure. No,
but
when
you only have a few minutes and a few dollars, you've got to be, even if you're just goofing around and don't know what you're doing, because obviously we didn't, we kind of learned by trial and error, of course. And then we would go, oh, you know what? This is going to be very expensive if we don't know what the hell we're doing.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. It kind of brings into focus stuff that, as obviously as you become a professional filmmaker, are really important, whether you're a producer or a director. Stuff like a budget, stuff like who's going to do what job, you know, who's got
right,
what costumes, who's got... And so there's... I think there's something with those that early... recording technique of Super 8 and like you say, cassette tapes or reel to reels and things like that, where you know you have to be not only inventive, but you also have to have that kind of like professional side of you, where even if you're goofing off, you say, well, let's at least sit down for 5 minutes and plan this rather than just some silly thing, you know.
Well, exactly, and we fed off our audience's notes. If we showed a movie and a gag didn't work or something, well, it was instantaneously.
Yeah.
You know, we'd go out and shoot another scene, you know, and or we'd just most likely edit the gag out, shorten it, or do some editing and revising. And it was just great. It was like a wonderful game of tennis. And everybody benefited, and we got, you know, they were laughing, and, you know, and we could see where their response, you know, where you kind of squirm in your seat, and you go, okay, we better make that scene stronger. Let's cut that out. And it was an incredible, right almost out the gate, you know, after showing, I think, our first film, which had no editing in it, and it was only 3 minutes long, throwing Twinkies at each other. But, you know, we showed it at our clubhouse, and everybody reacted great. But, you know, the parents said, hey, let's chip in and buy those guys an editor. Talk about a left-handed compliment. Oh, shit. You know what, though? We learned, and we edited most of our films on the back of a plastic Super 8 film can that had the imprints for regular 8 and Super 8, and we used a razor blade and splice tapes. That's how raw it was. I mean, you're literally, you know, you've got your hands on the film. It's very analog.
Yeah.
It's really amazing, you know. And now everything is just kind of like, you know, you've got this wall of technology between you where you never really touch anything, you know?
Right, of course.
Well, emulsion on film. And you know what? I got to say, at the end of the day, I like it better now.
Yeah.
The biggest pain in the A of the old school is the lighting. I had an old joke, why don't cinematographers smoke? Because it takes them 3 hours to light it. And it's like, oh, man. It's like, you know what? I mean, look, again, like, here's the thing that you kind of were alluding to earlier. There's something about film and lighting that takes 3 hours that has that look.
Right.
But I think you can get close to it for, you know, a quarter of that and quickness. And I hated the cameras and I hated that. I mean, actually, I hated film. It was always breaking and bubbling up and causing trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, the last film, when I directed Hostel 3 a few years back, we shot on Super 16 and just laid it all off, you know, into the digital world.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, okay, good. That's great, because at least you get a little bit of that. You get, you know, something there.
Yeah.
You know, considering the first film that I co-wrote and produced, we did kind of what they did on Evil Dead, where you do a 16-millimeter blow up to 35-millimeter.
Yeah.
And that was great to go through that experience. What, I mean, my God, I got to make films, and that was also my education. That was me going to school. Oh, man, what a great deal.
Well, the only thing I kind of alluded to, I mean, I made a joke about Paranormal Activity, but I mean, the reason why I alluded to kind of laughing a little bit about sort of the people who do make just a film on their phone or whatever, it's just that it doesn't necessarily it doesn't teach them to have that planning, you know what I mean? They can do whatever they want, they can shoot 1,000 takes, they can, you know, whatever it is. And some people are going to be successful just riffing like that, and they're going to be able to put something together. But that's going to be one in a million who is going to be good at actually just putting together sort of disparate strands. It kind of makes it, having that formative years, while digital is much easier to work with, cheaper, quicker, better to light and all the rest of it, having those formative years on Super 8 and on film must benefit you now, I guess, when it comes to
Well, John, also listen, look, they released everything back in the day, and all the drive-ins in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, virtually everything got released. Otherwise, they'd be releasing it on DVD now or something.
Right.
Or Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But everything got released. Even the worst movie got, you know, a drive-in showing somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's the amazing thing to me of, like, I guess there weren't as many bad movies made back in the day, maybe. I don't know. I haven't done an actual study on this.
Right.
It's just a gut feeling. But I'm just saying, you know, and there were some bad movies back in the day, and maybe I have a little more nostalgia for the fact that a bad movie from 1970 is better than a bad movie from today. You know
right.
what I'm saying?
Well, because you had to raise money, you had to find people, you had to, like, there was more to it, I think.
Yes, and it's everything, you know, you can see the grain of the film, and even the slickest flicks, and there's just a texture there that kind of, in a way, in CGI, kind of harms this. Now, CGI can also be very clever, but the best CGI is when you don't realize you're seeing it in some ways. I know if you're seeing some gigantic, you know, Transformer, and like, all right, come on. But I'm just saying, it's just there's something a little cooler in it, and there's just some oomph there in the old school stuff CGI just can't seem to create. At this stage, I'm sure maybe they'll probably nail that in the next few years.
Maybe. I'll take Tom Sullivan's stop motion animation at the end of Evil Dead over any Transformer film a million times over. But that's me personally.
Oh no, I'm a sucker for all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Yeah, no, I really am. And it, like, show me the wires. Show me all its warts.
Yeah, definitely.
And you know, I'm. You know, I'm just a big fan of, like, Irwin Allen and the Voice of the Bottom of the Sea and the flying sub. I mean, I actually thought that thing. Wouldn't it be cool to have a flying sub that looked like that and it could go out of... I mean, I really thought that existed. That's how great... But I just caught a couple of episodes recently, and I'm stunned at how great the model work is. It's absolutely... Of course, it was the Lydeckers who did all the classic the miniature work in the Republic serials of the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
They were... But I'm just... The design of the ship... I was like, what in the, oh, this is great. I'm like, you know, I was kind of ready for it to go, okay, this is going to be really cheesy. And yes, some of it is, don't get me wrong. But the miniature work is amazing, the concept of the shots. And I'm like, wow, man, that's amazing.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The flying star, but I digress, getting off onto the
No, not at all.
Well, a lot of our, you know, most of our films are special effects now, and at least in the horror arena, and that's always a weird thing, too, of like, you know, you just always wish you could use practical effects when you can, but sometimes CGI. I mean, Robert Rodriguez has a completely different take on it. He goes, I just use the CGI bloods because, you know, I can take the time with other cool scenes, and I'm going, oh yeah, I love that. That's totally legitimate, and I think that's really cool.
But I think
that's at least how I interpreted what he was saying. I might be off my mark, but I think I get the gist.
I think he kind of builds it into his style. So like his style is sort of very unique.
Yeah,
it's not,
that's what it is.
And if you're watching CGI in a Rodriguez movie, it seems different because he's doing it with some sort of purpose or some sort of like overt.
Good point. It's not just laziness.
Right.
It's almost he's making it work for him.
Yeah. Definitely. Certainly with like the Grindhouse and the Machete and those kind of movies where.
Machete.
That's awesome. So the current project, for people who don't know, you have put together a DVD of the Super 8 shorts. So just talk to us a little bit about how that came about and where that idea came from and how you went forward.
Well, I think it's Rob McLean, who runs the Evil Dead website over there in the UK. And my old buddy Bill Ward, who he was the guy with the movie camera.
Yeah.
And we kind of formed we kind of made a little horror parody called Inspector Clouse Saves the Day with my buddy Matt DeWan, and then we kind of morphed into the Three Stooges suddenly thereafter for some reason.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of, he had a movie camera and we just kind of got together and started. See, we were into Famous Monsters, you know, and we wanted to buy movies like The Phantom of the Opera or whatever in the back of a magazine. And Bill Ward's like, hey, man, I got a movie camera. We can make our own. I'm like, oh, yeah, great. All right. What do we know about it?
Yeah.
So we just went for it and kind of never looked back. It kind of steamrolled. And then, of course, going to high school and, you know, Bruce Campbell, I first meet actually in Sunday school. We were both raised Christian Scientists, and we were in the same Sunday school class. But, you know, when you go to Sunday school, like back then in the day, it was like, oh, there's no time for comedy. You just didn't say anything. You nodded.
Right.
I don't know. It was just weird. It's probably why I'm an agnostic right now, but whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I bought a praying mantis. I found out it was an atheist. No, I'm sorry. That's a bad joke. But be that as it may, I knew Bruce sat there for years, and we never spoke. And then guess what? I see him at study hall, like in eighth grade, and he tells me the whole plot of the Poseidon Adventure as if he just wrote this script. I mean, he just was so excited about the movie. He really got – I always loved Lost in Space and Voyage and Land of the Giants and the Time Tunnel, all those great shows. I mean, really, they hold up marvelously. But, I was late to the party scene, Poseidon Adventure, and he told me, and we became fast friends ever after. And, in fact, he was a professional actor even as a child. You know, because his dad was a local actor at St. Dunstan's, and Bruce was in The King and I when they did a production. He played the little kid in it. I don't really remember any of that, you know, except for et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, Bruce showed up, and we were just, you know, Bruce Campbell, I mean, excuse me, Bill Ward and Matt Taylor and myself, we were just being in a T-shirt. We go, we got to look like adults, and we just borrowed an old dirty, you know, dad's, suit coat and threw it on. And here comes Bruce with his makeup kit, his costume, fake mustaches, and it was really serious time. And that was amazing. And he that was back in 73. And, boy, did we bond very fast and just ended up, we just – And it's funny too because by about 1974, Bill was starring in plays and at in high school, and of course, met a very nice lady, and so we were a little stunted, you know.
Yeah.
Well, girls are corny, although in our films you can kind of see when we start getting the girl bug, you know.
Hey,
you know, because
right.
it's all guy shit, you know. It's just a bunch of guy crap, and then all of a sudden you're just going, oh wait a minute, who's that little cutie? I mean, not to be sexist, but you know.
No, but like Cheryl Guthridge, you've got Cheryl Guthridge starts coming into the films, Alan Sandweiss, people like that.
Yes, and in fact, I was in a play. That's how we found Cheryl. I was in a play. I played the mayor and Bruce produced it. Summer production of The Music Man.
Yeah.
And she was Amaryllis, and three short years later, she's our leading lady in It's Murder, which was our first Super 8 feature film. That really was a springboard to Evil Dead.
But now you're releasing a lot of these early films. You're making them available to fans eventually. Where did that idea come about to release them now in 2017?
I don't know. I think Bill Ward and Rob McLean both approached me via email and just kind of ran it past me. I said, why the hell not? I think it's cool because these films are getting old, and it would just be great to have them on another medium. And
yeah.
Who the heck knows? You know, it's a Super 8 film, and it's just brittle, and it's like, oh, man. I mean, I know there's technology that we could transfer them, but it's just, I don't know. Just seemed like a cool time to do that and go, oh, okay, excellent. Why not?
Yeah, you know? No. And I mean, we're really glad you're doing it. I mean, I think Josh Becker put a couple out a few years back, a couple that he had done. And
Yes, exactly right.
I know that although it never got on a DVD release, Within the Woods is floating around. Like, I've seen that, and it's been bootlegged multiple times. But they did prep it.
Well, guess what? For some reason, I have everybody's movies. It makes me nervous.
Yeah.
I have Bruce's early movies, Sam's early movies, my early movies, and our early movies.
Yeah.
That joke, the guy with three kids marries a woman with four kids, and then they have two kids themselves, and it's like, honey, your kids and my kids are beating up our kids. But I mean, it's so weird. I'm like, and just recently, Sam requested Within the Woods.
Yeah.
So I'm going, oh, okay, you know, and I think they already rescored it. I don't know if it's coming out or when it's
coming out,
but they did snag that. And I should have mentioned that. Hey, what about Clockwork? Because that was a cool little, 10-minute tale of terror that preceded Within the Woods. But maybe they'll, you know what? I never question Sam.
No.
He knows exactly what he's doing. He's a very smart man, and I admire him greatly. He really knows. I think he's going to use that Clockwork as another incentive for another set of something coming up.
Awesome.
So at least I've got all the films, and it makes me nervous. But anyway, I've taken care of them. And they've been stored in a cool, dry place. So there you have it.
That's awesome. And you've said that obviously if this set is successful, you'll continue to release them. Have Bruce or Sam or Josh or any of the other people from those earlier days are they aware of the project? And are they?
I haven't talked to Josh in eons, but I did speak to Bruce about it. Definitely, yes, exactly. And he seemed pretty cool about it. He was like, you know, oh man, we gotta get new transfers. I'm going, look, the films were, I mean, we had one copy. I mean, it's almost like if you see these films now, it looks like we optically added the scratches, like it's some, you know,
right.
retro MTV, you know, music video. It just makes me laugh, but I kind of wear it as a badge of honor because you know what? It's just everything's looking too good lately.
The technology, I
can see all the mistakes. I can see all the actors' bad teeth and their acne, and it's weird. It's weird, man. Maybe I'm seeing too much.
No, yeah, you can see the crease in the makeup.
It's be careful what you wish for, because I'm going, wow, man, I saw the string on that. I've seen this movie 8 times, and I never saw a string before.
Yeah. You can see people's toupees flapping about now in the high def. When you get together with one or more of the old Michigan Mafia, as we call you guys, do you guys ever discuss the possibility of, like, making little indie movies again for yourselves, like the Super 8 times, sort of bypassing the Hollywood machine and doing a few little things, like either in California or Michigan or somewhere? Or does that never come up?
Oh, I don't think it comes up. I think we're all pursuing whatever projects we're pursuing at the time, still going from the basic template, you know. What's the material? Who's going to produce it? Where are you going to get the dough? Although, you know, the whole financing thing is up in the, you know, it's anybody's guess right now. It's great. There's so many different sources of potential.
Yeah.
You know, financing, it's almost a little crazy, but it's better to have more options than that. Definitely.
And I think we as fans, as much, and you know, we love all of you guys' work and everything you guys putting out. Certainly I do, and I know a lot of the internet does. We follow a lot of your stuff. But there is that thing, if you've been a fan long enough and you kind of know about the Super 8s and maybe you've seen a couple of them, there's that part, or you can remember like the earlier films, there's a part of you that's like, oh, it would be great to see what they would all do if they just kind of got together and made like a scrappy little movie now and kind of released it on the internet or something, you know?
And that's the thing with everybody's schedule and just trying to time the thing would be so weird. But, you know, I kind of like the way you're thinking in a way, and that perhaps there could be a little project where everybody could do, you know, it within a certain format. Say it was an omnibus or a trilogy, whatever.
Yeah.
And you know, Bruce and I could do one, and then Sam and Bruce could do one. Or I don't know. You know, that's what was kind of cool about the Masters of Horror back in the day, because then you can, you know.
Oh, that was such a good series.
Certain group of, yeah. I know, and I'm just shocked over Toby Hooper's death.
I know, it's tragic. Grief. Oh, so tragic. And a year ago was Wes as well. We lost Wes Craven a year ago, so.
And then George Romero earlier.
Yeah, so it's been a hell of a couple of years
for
horror. Yeah, we've got
it. Yeah. It's making me nervous.
It is.
I know. These are three titans of terror.
Definitely.
You know, the Nightmare on Elm Street and Texas Chainsaw Massacre and, of course, Night of the Living Dead. My goodness. All right.
Yeah, and when you talk
about... I always love that line. I don't know where the hell it's from, but it's like, tomorrow is promised to no one. It sounds Star Trekian, but it's like, where is that from? It's like, why did somebody have to put it so succinctly? That sucks.
Yeah, it does. It's a tragedy. But when you're talking about practical effects, I mean, those guys worked with some of the greats and did some incredible work. So, one of the ultimate Super 8s that would lead eventually to The Evil Dead was Within the Woods. We've been talking about that. In that movie, you got to play the part that was intended for you of Scotty. What do you remember about putting together Within the Woods specifically compared to other Super 8s? Because Sam was obviously going to use it as a selling tool.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy because I was working like the night crew at Kroger's grocery store in Michigan.
Yeah.
And we squeezed that film in on a succession of weekends, and it, you know, so for me, I was just like, I literally was like going on about 3-4 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
So I almost felt like I myself was possessed in a different way of like just being propped up by coke. So,
right.
You know, I almost felt like it was like some sort of a weird out of body experience. Because it was intense, but no, it was amazing. And I would come to Kroger's, and you can tell it's cherry pie filling, but that's, you know, I got that at Kroger's, and I would just bring like a lot of the props. And I remember that film incredibly well. I remember Sam with his shot list.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I might have some of those actually, believe it or not. I'm not sure. Maybe they're for Evil to the Dead.
Yeah.
But I had some shot lists, and I remember Doug Sills, who's now an actor, and he worked on it behind the scenes. I remember everything about it. I remember getting those two old those Coke bottles at a little store in Marshall, Michigan, and it was just, it almost had its own Texas Chainsaw vibe, in the sense that we were out in the middle of nowhere, and like, okay, so I live in Michigan, but this is out, this could be another state for all I know. I don't know what Marshall, Michigan is. What is that?
Yeah.
You know, home of Tom Sullivan. Okay, that's cool. But, and that's where Rob Tappert had that farm. But I remember everything. It was cool. And Bruce Campbell got the best laugh because they had to, you know, stab me in the movie, right?
Yeah.
And he stabbed me in the movie. And, of course, you know, I've got, like, the Tom Selleck chest in terms of hair. Oh, shit. And they duct taped everything and just ripping that duct tape off.
Oh,
it was, it was like, wait, I'd rather be stabbed with a knife. And Bruce was laughing. It's just, it's a great thing to laugh at because it was so frustrating. I'm like, wait, this is hurting way more than I ever could even imagine. This is stupid. but it was hilarious. And I got an education on match shots and how the end of It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World was put together with all these miniatures, and I had no idea. Tom Sullivan was so ahead of his game. Really just wonderful time because, you know, he had to make me up as a monster, and he gave me the greatest compliment. He goes, man, I like your monster better than the one I right. Then for Hal Thalrich, although maybe I'm speaking sacrilege, I go, you know what? I do too.
Yeah.
That monster at the end is really scary. I don't mean to diss anything. I mean, you know, Evil Dead's the classic that it is, and all
right.
of the monster makeups are awesome in it. So, but I just, you know, it's just a really kind of a cool thing. And an interesting note too is that in one of the last Super 8 on this particular volume set, we did a teaser called Curse the Werewolf, where Bruce Campbell, I play a werewolf, and I kill Bruce Campbell in the opening credits. He's a hunter out in the woods. And the camera's right over my arm, and it goes right toward Bruce and grabs him by the throat. And there's a similar shot in Within the Woods, you know, when Bruce attacks Ellen, and she smashes her onto the table with the Monopoly board there. And I was like, you know, again, a lot of this stuff, you see other people's work. I've been inspired, obviously, visually by a ton of Sam shots and everything else. But I was like, I'm going, yeah, I never discussed it with Sam, but I'm going, maybe he could have been influenced by that shot or not, because it was such a distinctive shot, particularly in any of our earlier Super 8 careers, because it's such a distinctive shot.
Yeah.
Oh, cool, you're kind of over the shoulder. Because my arm was all hairy, I was wearing a short-sleeved shirt, so you get to see the werewolf arm. And,
yeah.
And that was pretty cool, a radical shot for its time, you know, since just the short before we're throwing Three Stooges pies and a basic, you know, master shot.
Right. Well, no, and also I think that's another, I mean, I had friends that I grew up with that I did creative stuff with, whether it was audio stuff or film or whatever. And I think that part of the charm of the story that would be the story of the Evil Dead, but all these Super 8s beforehand and everything else, I think when you first learn about that and you learn about all you guys and the friendships you had and the films you made and the stuff you did, like, there's a real, the tale behind the films, are certainly for those first few, are as rich and interesting and varied as the films themselves. And I think it shines through the work, you know, that group of you all kind of pulling together and creating something, is it kind of shines through the work, and it's certainly one of the things that we love about it.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, and there was just, you know, I mean, it could be its own little like a mini series, you know, because we're all like, we're trying to figure out, we're like John Cameron, he was one of our, the Metropolitan Film Group, if you will, a fellow filmmaker in our group. And he's like, we're all like ants trying to climb up a slippery anthill, and we're all trying to. So it was really a lot of fun to see, you know, and Sam, Bruce, and Rob really were the mavericks in terms of doing the whole Evil Dead thing, because that took, you know, that was a lot of, like, major life changes. I think, you know, Sam lost the love of his life over it, in terms of she just went on to somebody else. And because Sam was, like, on that film forever. And I'll never forget the time that they changed the title from Book of the Dead to Evil Dead over that span of probably a year and a half.
Yeah.
And remember, they got all kinds of promotional T-shirts and everything for Book of the Dead. Then they had to redo that again when the title got changed.
Yeah.
And they're like, Sam, that's you made another movie. He goes, no, it's the same movie. I'll never forget Sam telling me that with just kind of a sense of exasperation.
Well,
you know, because you just want the damn thing. You want to shoot it in a few months. You want to post it in a few months.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, a couple of months to set it up and get it out there, and then premieres a few months later. And that's almost how it went, at least once Evil Dead 2 went.
Yeah.
It went. It got the green light, and it just was out the gate, and that's kind of how it happened. I mean, there was some drama in there a little bit, but not too much. Once we got the green light, and like, oh, cool, I'm going to Hollywood with Sam to write this. So that's cool.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, so you do a little bit of fake champing on Evil Dead, but then when it comes around to Evil Dead 2, you're brought back into the fold, and you write the thing with Sam. So tell us.
They wanted me on Evil Dead.
Right.
I was like, guys, I'm making $25,000 a year. And I got to help support my family because they were financially hurting at the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't go back to my job. They're not letting me have the time off. You know, they needed me, you know, God, it turns out a hell of a lot longer than what they said, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I'm like, for $50 a week, are you kidding me? I was making $25,000 in 1979. Think about that.
Yeah, exactly.
That, I mean, that's good money now.
Right. Definitely. Outside of the big city.
For a teenager. Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah. So
there you have it.
But yeah, so you did when they moved the production back to Michigan, you did sort of some fake shimping and things on it, right?
Yeah, I got all my girlfriends and my friends in it to, you know, to double Cheryl and all the whole ending I worked on with. I supplied all the meat parts, kind of like how Mario Bava used, you know, tripe. Cow intestines for Kaltiki, the immortal monster, back in 1959. And those sat around for a long time. But, yeah, no, I helped out. And I was there when, you know, Teddy was doubling for Cheryl when the creature arms burst out, throwing all the meat. And, so all of that gore, I blew oatmeal through Scotty's sleeve, you know, as he was disintegrating.
Oh, it's such a great time.
Working with Bart Pierce and Tom Sullivan and of course, Sam, Bruce, and Rob, they were pretty effing amazing and still are.
Yeah. So you go on to Evil Dead 2, you write Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, I worked on Crime Wave too with Sam.
Right.
Helping him write scenes at Denny's restaurant at 2 in the morning. And he was wonderful, and I got my SAG card because of that movie. I got a girlfriend out of it. I was having the best time on Crime Wave while Sam, Bruce, and Robert being tormented beyond their wildest dreams. But it was kind of interesting because, Rob's like, oh, man, you're really helpful. I mean, like, I don't know. They thought I was just, I just didn't really want to come on and help them out on Evil Dead. I'm going, dude, I guess I didn't make it clear enough. But that really helped me with Evil Dead 2, you know, because those guys were having such a hard time. And I was just being as helpful as I could humanly be. And it was great that they were shooting in Detroit because I'm like, oh, okay, by that time I could, I think I was just kind of easing out of network and taking movie industry more seriously by writing more scripts and trying to get stuff made.
Yeah.
And then Bruce Campbell said, hey, Scotty, you want to be the extras casting dude? And I go, absolutely, let's do it. And of course, Sam got in trouble from Embassy Pictures. Is that Siegel kid in front of the camera? Sam put me in almost every other scene and they got in trouble because I wasn't SAG.
Right.
And that got me SAG, by the way. But we were just learning kind of as we went.
Yeah.
And but I still cherish that because we got to work with Emil Sitke, you know, the fourth stooge, and he was just such a great actor. And that movie had a lot of fun actors. And of course, Joel and Ethan Coen, we co-wrote the screenplay with Sam.
Yeah.
And so it was just a great time. But anyway, that really led to, like, you know, my involvement in Evil Dead 2 because Rob and Sam and Bruce were very thankful. And I'm like, hey, man, thank you. That was a great, fun gig. I made enough dough that I can kick back and start raising money for this other project. And it was great.
Yeah. And of course, if there were any of those Embassy guys still around to see Sam and the Coen brothers become what they were, they must have been kicking themselves that they interfered with that movie so much.
It's weird. It was really weird.
But
very weird.
But yes.
I mean, Ed Pressman was great and was in the movie. And as far as I know, was really behind Sam. But there were other powers that be. And I guess it all just came, you know, very weird. I don't know. I'm not quite sure. I just felt bad for my friends being kind of abused. And it seemed like they got taken advantage of by some of the people in some of those locations, I guess. Bruce Campbell's audio commentary on the Crime Wave Blu-ray is amazing.
I'm a big fan of his. His commentaries are always good to listen to. they're always great. But Evil Dead 2, it's in my personal top five films of all time, hands down. Many consider it the best of the series, and I've even heard Bruce say that it's his sort of personal favorite of the three, now four of them, if you take the TV series to be sort of the fourth.
Right.
So huge props for that, man, and it's just fantastic that it's one of the perfect blends of comedy, violence, gore, splatstick, horror. It's got and practical effects. It's got like everything. It's got everything that I love about like 80s horror filmmaking. Literally everything.
Funny, you know, Sam brought me on to do some demon voices for Ash versus Evil Dead, right?
Yeah.
And I guess it was the premiere episode, although I'm not 100% sure. I think it was.
Yeah, that's the one he did,
and,
the pilot, yeah.
Yeah, where they had the stock footage from Evil Dead 2 with Evil Ed coming up and attacking them in the cabin.
Yeah, that's it.
And it was hilarious because I'm like, I go, Sam, I'm revoicing myself.
Right.
I did that voice. And but it was hilarious. But one of the one of the people in the studio was making fun of Bruce's 80s hair in the Evil Dead 2 flashback clip. And I go, oh, my God, you're right. It is a little Mel Gibson-y, not quite Road Warrior, but it's getting there.
Yeah.
It's a little more poofy, and I'm like, oh, my God, I mean, because that was my favorite thing about Evil Dead films. The hair gives you away.
Right.
Because what is it? It's work boots, jeans, a cabin,
yeah,
and kind of a 70s car, but for the most part, it's almost timeless.
Yeah.
I mean, a cabin is so timeless. Wait a minute, what year could that cabin be? A cabin in the woods, it looks like it could be any decade.
Any decade, except, but, I mean, by the time you get to Army of Darkness, he's got a full-blown mullet in that movie.
Oh, my God, does he really?
He's got,
oh
like,
God,
the big,
really?
Long hair
I'm
out
scared.
The back.
I'm scared.
It's awesome.
Oh, no, because in other words, so the hair he had from 1979, 80, 81,
yeah,
that was probably the most timeless hairdo of all.
Right. And it's funny because Ash has kind of gone back to that now, that sort of short back and sides. He's now gone back to that in the TV series. But yeah, in Army of Darkness, his hair's quite long, certainly out the back. So after Evil Dead 2, you make Intruder, which is another favorite of mine. I'm a big slasher fan, and it's sort of got some of the most memorable slasher kills of all time in that film. So how much fun were they to come up with and then execute that stuff? Because you had KMB on that movie, right?
Oh, exactly. And not only that, I got to meet them because they were California working for Mark Sjostrom back in the day.
Yeah.
And they came out and did some additional gore scenes for Evil Dead 2 in Dearborn, Michigan. And I just hit it off with those guys. So that when I came back to went out to Hollywood, I talked to Greg, and I said, Greg, I can't afford you guys, but maybe could you – I'm going to do this, like, $130,000 film all in, and I can't afford you guys, but do you know somebody that might be able to – he goes, hey, I'll tell you what. You give us an upfront credit, and we'll do it for free. You pay for the materials. And I'm like, wow, that's a deal. I mean, I don't even know – I don't even think he said that. It was like that was the deal, and I'm like, how can I turn that down?
Yeah.
So that was their first film, and – It's where all those stars aligned, because I'm like, hey, I'm the first of the guys to actually direct a Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
Everybody else is directing them in, you know, the Morristown, Tennessee. And no, it doesn't matter where they are. Your first movie is your first movie, of course.
Right, right,
but
right.
It was nice to do it in Hollywood and have Lawrence Bender as my producer and be able to have Bruce appear in it and Lawrence Bender and Rob Tappert voicing some of the kill scenes, and then just amazing craft work of KMB, because you can't understand. I mean, we shot it in 2 weeks. My God, I mean, Sam Raimi said the greatest thing, because I'm not 100% sure, but I think Evil Dead 2, and it's a complicated movie, Evil Dead 2. It has a lot of stuff in it.
Yeah.
And I think that was at least 75 days. I'm not sure.
Right.
But here we are on the end of the first week of a 2-week shoot, and it's murder, because it's like, oh my God, you pay a lot of money for an extra hour's of sleep. And Sam goes, how are you holding up? He goes, I go, man, it's intense. He goes, and think, in another week you'll be done. Imagine, now just look at me on Evil Dead 2. Day 45. I got another 40 to go. It's like, no. And you know what? Boy, did that ever put it into perspective. But amazing. I mean, Sam really got hurt when that stunt into the Pepsi display got hit. And Sam was so conscientious as a director. I'm like, it was just great. I love, you know, Bruce Steers, he's a big screenwriter director now. He was one of the actors. And then there's Craig Stark, who was just in The Hateful Eight for Quentin.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody, and of course Lawrence Bender and Academy Award winning producer. And it was really, we got a lot of bang for our buck for a measly $130,000. And plus, it was great to work with Charles Band. I mean, Charles Band was fantastic. I didn't deal with him that much. He was very impressed that we were able to get Sam involved.
Yeah.
And he was really concerned about the title. You know, he liked, you know, he wanted to call it The Final Checkout. And I said, Charlie, how about this? Night Crew, The Final Checkout. He goes, I like that. And then it got changed to something else for other, you know, oddball reasons. But be that as it may, Albert Band, you know, he did that great Stephen Crane movie based on the Stephen Crane short story, Face of Fire, with Cameron Mitchell and James Whitmore from 1959. And it's one of the most amazing movies I've ever seen. Yes, I guess you would call it a horror movie, but it's just, and the damn shame of it is I hadn't seen it when I was working with him, because he kind of, Albert Band oversaw my, you know, Intruder. Yeah. And but I did tell him that. I go, man, oh, man, I want to see I told him I loved I Buried the Living, but I'd love to see it again, but it wasn't on a video. And he brought me my own personal copy that I have to this day.
Oh, that's amazing.
But Albert's a hell of a filmmaker. He directed I Buried the Living, one of the greatest no-budget horror films ever made. And Stephen King agrees with me. And then Face of Fire, it's on a whole nother level. If you saw Face of Fire, the best Cameron Mitchell and James Whitmore performance, man, that's amazing stuff. And I'm like, wow.
I need to check that out. I haven't seen that, actually. That's one of the few references I haven't seen, no.
Oh, it's great. And I had it in my library forever. And finally, you know what? I'm glad I did, because they came out with a great DVD of it.
Cool.
You know, like, you know, one of those just burn them up, you know, kind of no-frills thing you can get on Amazon. But anyway, right. It was amazing.
But that's nice.
But anyway, everything was amazing. It was just a lot of fun, and it was just great to work with Ted Raimi, Sam Raimi. I mean, all of these people. I mean, I really lucked out.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's a treat, I think, no matter when you kind of become a fan of this kind of movie making and this group of people. It's fantastic to have stuff like Intruder to kind of go back and discover. I mean, I became a fan sort of in 93 when I first saw Army of Darkness on VHS, and then I kind of went back and kind of found all these other films. But I, you know, with Synapse putting out the Blu-ray and various other things, like, there's some great stuff out there now that people can kind of go and discover. Thou Shalt Not Kill Except came out, which has got another amazing performance from Sam in it, which is well worth seeing.
Well, the thing was, it was just great because we all were very new to Hollywood, and it was a kind of a fun little film to break into Hollywood with.
Yeah.
Even though we technically shot it in Bell, California. But our studios were in Hollywood, and we got, you know, to work with Alvy Moore, who discovered Don Johnson and produced A Boy and His Dog and acted in it. He played Mr. Kimball on Green Acres and was a producer with L.Q. Jones of all these horror films like Brotherhood of Satan and The Witchmaker. And he was in our film, and we got Eb Dawson and Emil Sitka of the Three Stooges fame. And Emil Sitka was in a William Castle film called 13 Frightened Girls, where he got stabbed in the back.
Right.
It's a cool lobby card of him. And, yeah, and that movie has, you know, guys on meat hooks, and it's a little graphic for kind of a kiddie bopper film.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. And then to top it all off, Jonathan Ross, who we could call him Britain's David Letterman or something, he did a whole interview with Sam and Rob for the Incredibly Strange Film Show, and they interviewed me and everything on that set. We got a lot of mileage out of that no-budget movie, but it just everything, all the stars aligned, and it was just, I was very, very fortunate. But Sam was incredibly helpful, everybody. I was just truly amazing. I'm just glad it came out as well as it did, considering, you know, we wrote it in 2 weeks, shot it in 2 weeks, and posted it in maybe four, and that was it.
Yeah, and it always makes me laugh. I think there's a trailer out there for Intruder, I think back when it was still called Night Crew. And I'm going to forget the name right now, but whoever it was who was in 16 Candles, and that was at the time the big selling point of the film, apparently. And you think to yourself...
You're right. Oh, well, and we also had Renee Estevez, who was so cool, and I called her because I wanted to, I had some new dialogue for her, right. And Martin Sheen answers the phone.
Oh,
well, he was like one of the nicest guys, and I'm like, this is her father, Martin. I'm like, you know, but Renee was so classy. I mean, we got a lot of mileage with the folks, you know, for, you know, a movie that's just, you know.
Right.
It's the ultimate quickie.
But I just mean that, like, now, looking back at it, people are more likely to kind of discover that movie because of the sort of Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi and Ted Raimi and even Lawrence Bender, Quentin Tarantino connection than they are necessarily the person who was in 16 Candles.
I know. Isn't that funny? That's so funny. Yeah, the narrator of that promo says that. Yes, exactly. Well, she's since married one of the Zucker brothers.
Oh, wow, okay. The crazy Zucker brother? The crazy one that went off?
Yeah, Matt. David, or Jerry. No, Jerry, I think.
Oh, Jerry, okay.
Yeah, well, she's now Liz Cox Zucker.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
No, I'm sorry, that's terrible. That's horrible.
I just figured
Never
that out.
Mind.
I just got
no.
now again.
No, it was really lame. Good grief. So, Liz is great. I hope I'm having a little fun at her expense.
Fine.
She was amazing. And she taught me so much. She's going, you know, you're doing a movie like in 2 weeks, right? And you don't have any time. It's like, wait a minute, I look better from the other side. I go, it's going to take us 20 minutes to reset and everything. We're just going to have to go with it.
Yeah.
Cut to me seeing the dailies and going, you know what, she was right, but we just didn't have the time. Damn it. But luckily, I shot her from enough of the right angles, I think. But she was right. I you know, after that point, I go, you know what, I can't let time interfere with, I really have to listen to the actor.
Right.
I really have to listen to, you know, I mean, luckily, it was cool, but I'm like, the thing is, it's like, if you had told me 20 minutes before, I could have worked with you on that one.
Right.
You know, but it's like, oh, shit, there's no time.
Always,
and that's always a frustrating thing.
Always come prepared. Just going through again your career, just a couple more points. You wrote The Rookie, which Clint Eastwood directed. How much in a big sort of Eastwood Hollywood production like that changes from the page to the screen? And how much does Eastwood like the writers on the set? Were you involved with the final film at all, or did you just kind of write it with...
I was writing The Nutty Nut at the time, but I did make some special appearances and I was able to even be directed by Clint in a small scene near the end of the film where I play a baggage handler at this airport.
Yeah.
You know, excuse me. And so that was really cool. And my buddy Boaz, who co-wrote it with me, he actually asked Mr. Eastwood, you know, because he was intending on becoming a director, and I was already a director and then writing my next directorial effort while that was happening. And Clint graciously said, yeah. So Boaz ends up appearing in the film. He got to be directed by the great Clint Eastwood. And I came in, but just enough is like to where Clint goes, hey, where you been? I'm going, oh, that's exactly what I want him to say. Right? Not you again. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
Oh, geez. And it was an awkward moment where the guy, one of the producers that brought us into the fray, not Howard Kazanjian, who was great. You know, he was George Lucas's producer and produced all kinds of cool stuff. And Howard was, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark and, you know, Empire and all these great, you know, classics. But, you know, there was kind of a problem, and so Clint had to remove him from the set. And Clint comes and explains to the writers. I'm like, you don't have to explain it. It was just the writers. It was great, too, because he goes, all right, for Charlie Sheen's father, and Clint addresses Boaz and me, and for Charlie Sheen's father, you know, Robertson, Tony Franciosa, or Tom Skerritt. And we're like, all right, Cliff Robertson. And, okay, the writers want Cliff Robertson. The writers will get Cliff Robertson. And I'm like, oh, shit. But I don't know. That didn't work out, so we want Tom Skerritt, who's equally cool.
Right.
I mean, they were all great actors. But, you know, Cliff Robertson's Charlie, you know. He won an Academy Award. He was Uncle Ben, as it turned out.
Yeah.
And I read just one of the last blurbs I read on Cliff Robertson before he died. And Sam Raimi wanted Cliff Robertson for Spider-Man 3. And I think Cliff Robertson said something so heartfelt. He goes, oh, it's just nice to be wanted at this age. And I'm like, ow.
Yeah.
Oh, he was just very grateful that Sam was, you know. I'm like, oh, this is like, oh, man. That's pretty cool, but I digress. But it was just like, man, I don't know. It was really just amazing. In fact, Shane Black, you know, the big writer-director,
yeah.
I thought he was auditioning because he had done a small role in Predator.
Right.
And he goes, oh, no, my girlfriend's auditioning for, you know, ultimately the Laura Flynn Boyle role. But it was really an amazing time. We got to be on the set. He fed the crew, like, lobster and lamb chops and – oh, my gosh, he took care of his crew. I got to, you know, I got to do a stunt, and Terry Leonard, the great stunt guy, got to push me up and you know, pad me up and everything. It was just really just an amazing thing to work with all of these veterans. And by the way, all the people that I worked with, I was watching a lot of the old Clint Eastwood films. He puts them in the movie.
Yeah.
Clint puts, like, the scriptwriter, Lloyd, was an actor, and, like, I don't know, he was in one of these low-budget Abominable Snowman movies back in the 50s. Because Lloyd was an actual actor, and he's just a script guy, and he also had a small role in The Rookie. But it was almost kind of really cool in a way of like end of Cinema Paradiso.
Yeah.
Where, I don't know if you ever saw that film, but it was like, you know, he gets to see the entire... I don't want to wreck the movie. It's too many spoilers. Anyway, as long as you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
It was great to be able to put all the pieces together. I'm like, oh, there's Clint Stanton. He has two lines in that scene. Oh, there's... And it was just like, oh, it's just really cool. But he was so amazingly gracious. I learned so much. I met Francis Fisher on that movie.
Yeah.
Talked to Raul Julia. I thought he was yelling at his kid, but forgot that Raul Julia's... He's got this stage voice. I want you to come here. And I'm like, oh, I thought he was yelling at him, but it's like he's playing to the back row. And Sonia Braga was so amazing. I can't believe we were allowed to just hang around. And I think, well, and you know, and you know, I was working on the film actually.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know what I did? I can't believe nobody did it. Here we are shooting in San Jose International Airport. Clint's firing off this famous Smith & Wesson, whatever the hell it was. I'm just not a gun guy, but I just thought it was cool. And there's all these shells on the floor.
Yeah.
And I look around and I just swiped them. Like, what are they going to do with it? And it's so ironic that was the last movie of that type he ever made.
Yeah.
I mean, he played a, you know, a bodyguard in Line of Fire, but I don't think he ever did a Dirty Harry type action movie like that ever again.
Yeah, not really. I mean, Gran Torino has its moments, but it's nowhere near anything like that.
Right, and it's not cop oriented. It's not running after. Right. You're right. Gran Torino has its
little moments, but I mean, you know, Unforgiven, I guess, as a Western, has that kind of throwback action stuff in it.
Yeah. You could say yes, same kind of thing, different era.
But the Rookie is sort of it's. He didn't do a lot of buddy cop stuff. Like a lot of other people did kind of the buddy cop stuff till it was kind of grounded
for a while. Ford and, you know, Penny Dreadful guy. I forget his name, but anyway, yeah, exactly, yeah.
But no, Eastwood really only did that one. I'm trying to think of other buddy movies. I mean, yeah, Dirty Harry, but Dirty Harry tends to either lose a partner, his partner quits, his partner dies, or he goes off on his own. So it's not really the buddy thing that the Rookie has, which is kind of fairly unique, I think.
Well, when we were talking to him about the, you know, the script changes, which were pretty minor, he wanted us to delete a sewer scene and where they escape. And what was amazing by that time, I told him that I loved Play Misty for Me, and we just talked about it for so long. And then Boaz, he goes, he mentioned like the spaghetti westerns, and I was like, nah, it's like, I don't really want to go there. But it was just like, it was kind of funny that way in that, he loves that, and I told him, I said, Clint, I tried to call him Mr. Eastwood, and he's like, no, that's my father's name. But so I was like, Clint, you know, I didn't know that this script would land on your desk, but there's a whole sequence where the Charlie Sheen character is racing to save his girlfriend from the psycho, and I lifted that from the end of Play Misty for Me, and he goes, it worked then, it'll work now. And the cool thing is, they were talking about getting Don Siegel. I mean, Invasion of the Body Snatchers is like my top 10 favorite movie list of all time.
Yeah.
Not even science fiction.
Right.
But just because I give extra stars if you make something out of nothing.
Yeah,
and he had so little, and he did so much with it. It's amazing.
Oh, it's
of course,
great
it's
movie.
Great to have David Lean that has everything. You know, David Lean. All right, you're a genius. Shut up.
Right.
Nah, he's great. But man, to try to be Edgar G. Ulmer and make the Black Cat when it's all just smoke and mirrors, or Mario Bava. You know, these guys that kind of, I don't know, they're just really great visionaries in a lot of way, and making so much out of so little.
Yeah. No. Definitely. And sort of
Sam Raimi.
Right, and Sam
exactly.
Raimi.
Right. Sam with Evil Dead. I mean, what was that all about?
Completely.
$90,000.
The fact that you know, the way Evil Dead gets pulled together and eventually gets released and sort of now becomes this, you know, is now a legitimate classic. It is, you know, it is a horror classic that is mentioned in the same breath as, you know, Night of the Living Dead,
Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Halloween. Yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm stunned. That probably happened. I noticed it maybe 10 years ago. Although Spin Magazine, God, maybe 20 years ago, had like of the 100 coolest movies. I don't know if it was just of the 80s. I don't know. I think they meant of ever. that Evil Dead 2 was on number one. I'm like, oh, it's a sequel? Other than Godfather 2, I mean, are you putting me on? I thought it was a joke.
No, I mean,
100 coolest movies, are you putting me on?
No, Evil Dead 2, it's got to be number one of the 100 coolest movies. It's up there, man. It's such a great achievement. So one of the things sort of talking to you tonight has been so fascinating is obviously your love of all film and everything from sort of TV serials and films and everything else, which obviously you share a passion with Quentin Tarantino. He's been very vocal about his film fandom and love and encyclopedic knowledge. You introduced Lawrence Bender, the man who would go ahead and become his producer on so many of his early films. What was the relationship with Quentin like originally? And were you on all those sets of those movies which when like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, like when he first started out, or were you just the catalyst and then you were just sort of friends?
No, I was on the sets of those movies. In fact, my favorite special thanks credit, they felt so bad that they left me off the special thanks of the movie Reservoir Dogs that they went, oh, crap. Oh, well, let's put them on the Reservoir Dogs CD for now. And, you know, it's cool. I get a special thanks. Kurt Cobain, Scott Spiegel. I go, oh, the one and only time my name will be next to Kurt Cobain. Okay, for what it's worth. I love
it. Yeah.
But the coolest thing is people actually called me up. And I hung out on the set of Pulp Fiction, and I was just amazed. I had so many fun stories. But all of a sudden, people call me up and goes, hey, man, you're the first name up on Special Thanks. And I'm like, oh, my God. So my favorite Quentin and Lawrence movie, of course, is Pulp Fiction. I just thought, man, oh, man, that's an amazing thing. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I could just keep watching it, and it's just great. And all of their other stuff is pretty amazing, too. But I just thought, oh, you know what? I really dig Reservoir Dogs. That's amazing. And Jackie Brown's the underdog.
Oh, but, see, I'm a big Pam Grier fan, so Jack and Robert Forster fan. So, like, Jackie Brown to me was just incredible.
I had the best Pam Grier story.
Oh, tell me. That's amazing.
Because Quentin came back from Cannes. He said, Scotty, give me all the varieties and Hollywood Reporters. So he went away to Cannes to promote Reservoir Dogs and came back like an international, you know, rock. His Reservoir Dogs took off like, you know, it took off. And it was amazing to see him come back, you know, I mean, sleeping on my couch, come back, and I have all the stack of stuff. And he had all these Pam Grier movies. He had Foxy Brown, you know, Coffee, everything. I'm watching the movies because I go, you know what? He was filling me in. We were going nuts with Pam Grier, right? And at night I have, and because Quentin was talking about Fort Apache, the Bronx, I go, I haven't seen that. And he tells me about it, and I have a nightmare about it.
Yeah.
I have a nightmare that I'm in some horrible place in New York, and she's a policewoman.
Yeah.
And she comes in and saves my ass from these bad guys. And I told Quentin that the next day, and he laughed, and he told Pam Grier that.
Yeah.
So guess who calls me? And I'm so glad I wasn't home. Quentin gets her to call me and leave a message on my machine. Hello, Scotty. This is Coffee, and I'm going to cream you. I'm like, what? It's really Pam Grier. So cut to 5 years later, I meet her at one of Quentin and Lawrence's big bashes at Lawrence Bender's fancy place in Holmby Hills, right?
Yeah.
And there's, I get to meet Pam Grier. Quentin introduced me. She goes, you're Scotty. I go, what do you mean? She goes, you had that dream. I'm like, what is going on? How do you remember a dream? It's like Quentin remembers everything. It won't let. I'm just, it's like the funniest. It's just the greatest. I remember the coolest story. And I just thought that was so cool. Why does everybody, do I have just a bad memory? I mean, how do people remember? It's the most ridiculous thing.
That's fantastic.
Pam Grier is amazing.
So when,
I got to go on the set too, that held Della Alma Mall when they're doing the whole suitcase.
The pass off, and
because we were also had meetings for From Dusk Till Dawn 2 and 3.
Yeah.
So it was cool. Quentin's like executive producer of those, right? So he's directing Pam. Okay, cut. All right, lunch. Boom. Okay, now for the sequel From Dusk Till Dawn, I was like, oh, it was pretty amazing times. You know, I'm just like, wow.
Yeah, no,
this
definitely.
Is crazy.
And a funny thing about Fort Apache, the Bronx, when they were showing all of Pam's films at the Lincoln Center here in New York, they did.
I know she played like a junkie in the film or something.
Right.
You know, that like dreams never make a lot of sense.
But
huh?
No, but that, well, that's what makes me. It's kind of a bit odd because she was at the Lincoln Center. She was doing this Q&A. She was talking talking about Fort Apache, the Bronx, and she was saying how she saw it as her big break because she's working with Paul Newman and da-da-da-da-da, and she was talking about how she wanted to do it all method and figure it out and all the rest of it. And you kind of think to yourself, like, it really says something that she was the star of some movies that will live forever, Coffee, Foxy Brown, movies like that, that are incredible, and yet playing a, like, drugged-out hooker in a Paul Newman movie, she considered her big break. Like, it's kind of a weird mindset.
Oh, my God, that's a great... Well, you know what? Remember, she had that whole scene with the wolf, with Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction that got cut out.
Right.
And I remember Quentin acting that whole sequence out in my living room. And when Quentin acts the scene out, he's pacing back and forth.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's because my apartment's so small. But the thing is... The thing is, Quentin had to cut that out, and he told her, he goes, you know what, I'm gonna star you in a whole nother project.
Right.
And she goes, yeah, like, I never heard that one before, Quentin. Cut to Jackie Brown.
She's like,
her jaw dropped. She told me that.
But she's incredible in that movie. How she didn't win
awesome. Every
single award for that film. She's unbelievable. Oh. She's an incredible actress.
And just completely put her in another stratosphere. We're sitting with Robert Forster. It's like, all of a sudden, we're like, hey, we got work. This is great. I was there at when Quentin was considering directing an episode of The X-Files when it was still on the air,
hanging
out at his house one the Sunday night. And Michael Parks goes, Quentin, thank you for getting me into the From Dusk Till Dawn movie, man. I was able to save my house. I could pay my mortgage from the residuals. And I'm like, it's so Hollywood, right? It's like, Quentin, that was Michael Parks. And I hung out with Michael Parks when we did the From Dusk Till Dawn movies. And Jimmy Parks, as Quentin wrote and created a small role for him as the son of Michael Parks, his arranger in From Dusk Till Dawn 2.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, Jimmy Parks had that great role in The Hateful Eight, and he's done pretty damn well for himself. But I'm just so bummed that Michael Parks passed this year. But Michael Parks talked, I spent hours with him. He was talking about Jean Renoir and Betty Davis, and he smoked the Pall Malls, filterless Pall Malls right down to his fingers, index stained fingers, and it's just what a great opportunity that Quentin and I share the same love for a lot of these great actors that maybe somebody, you know, they forget, or, you know, David Lynch is pretty cool with some of the, you know, Russ Tamblins of the world, but, you know, it's just really cool that Quentin appreciates a lot of these people that are so easily forgotten or just kicked around.
Oh, no, definitely, definitely.
Underappreciated, yes.
Oh, yeah, no, completely. And they always, you know, they always have one thing in common, like the Forster and Pam Grier and Michael Parks and stuff, is that they're all phenomenally talented, and you often see these so-called A-listers who are incredible stars who don't have an ounce of the actual acting ability that some of these other people do that get resurrected. So that's wonderful. And just a funny note, my funny Pam Grier story, if you're at all interested, is that when we were at the Q&A and she was telling us all about getting method for Fort Apache, the Bronx, and she said, I put on this little skimpy dress and some fuck me pumps, and I'm walking along the street, and she gets up off her chair, and I'm sat in the front row of the little amphitheater there in the Lincoln Center, and she gets up off her seat, and she's walking along the front row, and she's like, and I'm walking up to men, and I'm doing this, and she puts her hand right into my beard. I've got a long beard, and she puts her hand right into my beard and looks right into my eyes and says, hey, honey, is that thing real?
And she's
so
at that, oh, shit.
Yeah, at that point, my jaw is on the floor. Like, I cannot speak for an hour afterwards.
Oh, my God, that is great. I can't blame you. What the hell? Oh, man, that's a story for life. Man.
Yeah. So I think it's the story I tell almost every single time Pam Grier's name comes up. She touched my beard, man. She touched my beard.
It's not as great as that just because Pam Grier is the coolest, but Clint Eastwood isn't chopped liver. But get a load of this, man. Clint and Charlie go to the Cannes Film Festival and come back. This is all during the shooting of The Rookie.
Sure.
And I guess what happened is that Clint and Charlie were stooping the same chick.
Okay.
And I'm like, what the heck is going on there? But somehow when Charlie found that out, she was wearing his, like, you know, $100,000 leather jacket. I don't know, whatever it is. It's movie star money, you know. I'm just a writer, right?
Right.
But I made a lot of money on that movie thanks to Charlie, because it was a bidding war, and he wanted to make it with Clint. And thank you, Charlie, for that great payday. I'll never forget you. And I'm serious about that, because it was like, I'm flat broke. I can't afford Jack. And all of a sudden, it's like, why, Paramount wants $375 for it. And Warner Brothers, I'm like, is this happening? Is this a joke?
Right.
I'm dreaming.
Yeah.
And it'll happen $500,000 later. But anyway, it's just amazing. But so get a load of this. Charlie was pissed and hit the girl and got his jacket back. And when Clint was talking about this when he got back, he goes, yeah, Charlie, me and the girls. I fuck him and he fucks him up. I'm like, what is this?
Wow.
I'm like, what the hell? How rude.
Wow.
But anyway, it's like, oh, my goodness.
That's a brutal line.
Like,
I said, that's a brutal line.
I swear to God, man. I mean, it was really cool. I came up with, it's nowhere near as good as Go Ahead and Make My Day. But did you know that exact line was used a year before in a movie called Vice Squad, starring Wings Hauser and John Getz of Blood Simple fame?
I've actually seen that.
And
I saw it on the big
yes,
screen.
Yes, and
in
John
New York.
Getz says the same thing. Go ahead, make my day. And he's a detective.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello. He says it a year before Sudden Impact. That was 1982.
Wow.
By the way, I didn't know it at the time.
No.
But I had that director. He's a terrific director. He directed Lisa and that great Raw Meat film, Gary Sherman. He did Dead and Buried.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he did Lisa with my neighbor, Don Moffat, who we used to have parties with. Don Moffat's neighbor, who was my neighbor, was Steve Buscemi for a while.
Right.
And, you know, it was just such a little Hollywood world, you know. It was really pretty, right in the heart of Hollywood. And it was like, but I never got to really, like, say, hey, Gary, you know, like, what the hell, man? You were the one. That's from your movie, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was shocked because it's not cribbed. That's the line. But at least with The Rookie, I got to go, you know, there must be 100 reasons why I don't blow you away, but right now I can't think of one.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we set it up earlier with, but it was like, oh, that's a little clunkier, but it was just cool that they went for it. I was like, oh, okay. If Clint thinks it's good enough to say, then it's good enough.
Exactly. Definitely, man. Well, look, it's been a hell of a conversation. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, John, you're the greatest, man. No, thank you for having me, man. This is I'm gonna have a dream.
Yeah.
About Pam Grier and you and your beard. And some weird thing's going to happen, and I'll tell Quentin when I see him.
Sure.
And then it's kind of like Groundhog Day. But, no, dude, that's a great story. Dude, I hate you. I'm going to just be thinking about that now.
and
that's great.
And then tell Quentin to come on my show, because we would have a great chat, I'm sure. Anyway.
It would be great. Every time he calls me to do something, I'm like off in Bhutan or somewhere else.
Right,
and I'm
right.
Oh, my, hate that timing, but that's just the way it is. But excellent, John. No, believe me. I'll put a good shout out for you if the timing, if all the stars can align.
Of course, man, of course. So just tell everyone where they can get Super 8 shorts. What should they do if they want to get Super 8 shorts? Where should they go?
Oh, well, I think there is a link, I believe, on the Evil Dead fan site, and that's run by Rob McClain, I believe.
Yeah.
And I think that's where one can get those currently.
It's www.super8shorts.com is what it is. Super8shorts.com for people.
You're way
who
ahead of
buy.
Me. Yes, exactly right. Yeah, I mean, look, I haven't even got my copy yet. I mean, I have the masters, but
yeah.
I want to see what it all looks like together, so I'm very excited. And yes, there might be a volume two with more, you know, where Bruce Campbell plays James Bond.
Oh, nice.
And Jimmy Hoffa, and we kind of grow out of our Three Stooges stage to make, you know, just regular stories. But Bruce Campbell is James Bond. That's, you know, gotta love that stuff. But,
one for the ages.
Thank you, John, so much.
No,
it's
thank
really
you,
great
Scotty.
Stuff.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, man. And I'll be picking up a copy myself. And have you got anything coming up that you want to tell people to look out for? Have you got any projects in the works?
Yeah. I've got The Dead Remember. What do you think of that title?
Oh, I like it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I do. I originally
Spooky.
Was called Pleasant Valley. I go, come on, this is a horror film. It's about skinwalkers.
Yeah, yeah.
So an underused monster. And I'm really excited about that. And that'll be after the first of the year. And then I have this other film called Wrath. and it's very evocative of some of the, you know, more cool aspects of, you know, the Halloween legend. But it's a cool monster witch movie.
Oh, very cool.
And it's almost like The Witch as Jaws along the coastline of California back in the 80s. So it's certainly got a, you know, kind of the 80s kind of freaky horror vibe, like, you know, what's the big show now on, what is it, the Netflix Strange Behavior? Is that what
Strange
it is?
Things. Stranger Things.
Stranger Things. Yeah. Exactly. Oh, no, Strange Behavior is a great 80s movie. I lied. that was retitled something else. Although Strange Behavior is not a bad title either. Oh, I'm digressing. But, yes, and so we are with a particular, the horror film fund, I believe it is, and I think we're on one of the top projects. You know, it's a $3 million low-budget horror flick, but I would be directing that, and I've been developing the script with a cool writer named Alex Sosin, and here you go. And of course, for the dead, remember, a buddy of mine who was an actor in Hostel Part 3, Rich Roney, wrote this really cool Skinwalker movie called The Dead Remember. So lots of stuff, and we'll just see exactly what happens first and how it all shakes down. But thank you for asking. I really appreciate that.
Oh, that's all good, man. So look, you've got my contact information. When those movies come out, we'd love a chance to review them and talk to you about them again and get some promotion out there and stuff. So if that's at all possible, let us know.
Oh, that'd be great, and I'd love to if you want to do that. You know, I remember one time when I was, like, 14, it's like, oh, that movie's stuck. I go, I'm 14 years old in a Sam Kinison way. Like, what do you expect? And Spielberg here? Get out of here. But it's fun to see with retrospect of, like, oh, that's what Bruce was doing in 1973. There you go.
Oh, no, it's awesome. Great. I will do that, sir. I will be in touch. And, when your movies come out next year, let's talk again. But thanks ever so much for your time today, man. It's been a real, real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much, John.
All right, take care and have a great night.
Okay, man.
Okay, so that was the absolutely fantastic Scott Spiegel. Wasn't that a great conversation? I hope you all enjoyed that. Don't forget to check out his super8shorts.com. That's the number 8, so super8shorts.com. If you want to pick up those early films of his and Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi and stuff, that is a great package. Definitely go check that out. And also, if you love all things Evil Dead, then please do head over to aftermoviediner.com, where we have spoken to Bruce Campbell, we've spoken to Ted Raimi, we've spoken to Tom Sullivan, we've spoken to the ladies of the Evil Dead. There are some great conversations on our site, aftermoviediner.com, for all things Evil Dead, as well as articles, reviews, and more. Do check it out. Thanks ever so much for listening, and have a great week.